Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 3rd, 2025, we are delighted to host a discussion entitled, What's the Harm? ESA Rulemaking After Loper-Bright. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. We are fortunate to have with us as our panelists, Professor Kerrigan Burke and Will Yateman. And we are grateful to have Jonathan Wood as our moderator. Jonathan is Vice President of Law and Policy at the Property and Environment Research Center. As a last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Jonathan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Matthew, and good afternoon, everyone. Today, we'll be discussing a recent proposal by the Fish and Wildlife Service to rescind a decades-old regulation interpreting the Endangered Species Act to prohibit destruction and modification of species habitat. That might sound like a pretty narrow thing that would only excite environmental nerds, but it's actually a pretty big deal for a wide variety of industries and land use activities. The regulation of habitat modification is one of the primary ways that the ESA has regulated the country over the last 50 years. And even beyond that, the proposal may have implications far beyond land use and species conservation, because it also raises serious questions about how Loper-Bright affects agency authority to reconsider longstanding regulations that they believe do not reflect the best reading of the statute. To debate those questions, we're fortunate to have Will Yateman, a senior legal fellow at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and Kerrigan Burke, professor of law at UC Davis and a senior fellow at the California Environmental Law and Policy Center. Our run of show today will be that each of our speakers will have 8 to 10 minutes for introductory remarks, followed by a moderated discussion and audience questions. So as Matthew said, please do add your questions as you have them into the queue, which I'll be monitoring and we'll sprinkle in once we get past the opening remarks. And with that, I believe we decided to start with Will.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. So I want to set the table. For about 50 years, the implementation of the Endangered Species Act, which I'm going to call ESA, it remained largely static. And now, all of a sudden, the ESA is in a high state of flux, as evidenced by this very webinar, which is among regulatory actions, deregulatory actions being taken by the second Trump administration on this statute. So a half century static, currently in flux. What happened? And in fact, there are three major political and legal currents or changes that have led to our present moment of ESA reform. And the first one, it was alluded to by Jonathan, it's the demise of Chevron deference. So at every juncture of the ESA, you find a rule propped up by Chevron. I'm an expert in these things, and I don't think there's any other regulatory regime, domestic regulatory regime, that was more deference dependent. So, of course, the harm definition rule, it reflects this. It was, you know, upheld. We all know Babbitt v. Sweet Home. Its viability is predicated upon Chevron. So in a world without Chevron, the ESA becomes legally vulnerable. All right. That's the first trend. The second change is the advent, the structural force, political force that is President Trump. So for 50 years, it was GOP orthodoxy to go to the middle on environmental statutes. You didn't want to rock the boat. You didn't want to alienate suburban housewives. That was the thinking. So Ford, Reagan, HW, they all fit this pattern. Well, Trump has smashed the mold, and perhaps, I mean, I'll speculate here, but that's the new norm in GOP, in GOP circles, is to take these sorts of positions. So that's the second force. And then the third one is the rise of these abundance folks on the left. So these are the people who have become sick of environmental statutes holding up development, all the red tape and whatnot. They bemoan the fact that these regimes make it impossible to build things in America. So the rise of the abundance folks, it's important politically insofar as it mutes opposition to these sorts of reforms. So these three factors, they converge in our present moment, leading to multiple ESA reforms, including the blockbuster one we're talking about right now. So, okay, that's the context. Let's turn to the rule per se. I want to discuss very briefly, echo or why Jonathan is so spot on when he calls this rule a big deal. It's not just that it would put an end to the Rube Goldberg-esque legal liability faced by private landowners possibly and accidentally in the future harming a listed species. Though that will occur, I mean, if this rule becomes law of the land, or that would be likely to occur, and that would be a welcome development. But it's broader than that. An expansive definition of harm, it ripples throughout the statute. It's the linchpin for the regime. So an expansive definition of harm causes permittees, or federal permittees, to face a more burdensome Section 7 consultation process. It results in private landowners being subject to more onerous habitat modification plans at the local level of government. So by shrinking the meaning of take, the proposed repeal would cut through ESA's copious red tape. I mean, it's not just these frankly absurd lawsuits, and that's my humble opinion. It's broader than that. It's the entire statute. This definition undergirds it. Okay, so that's why this is a big deal. Next, I want to briefly discuss possible changes to the final rule. And I think there are two possible changes that we might see from the proposal to the final. And the first is to put a little more meat in the bone. In the proposal, the agencies deleted the definition of harm wholesale. I think they might put the first sentence back in, which says that harm means an act which actually kills or injures a listed species. Multiple regulated entities have called for that. They say it'll provide a modicum of regulatory certainty here. And to be sure, they all support this proposed rescission. The second possible change I think we might see between the proposed rule and the final rule is that the agencies might delete a few words in the definition of harass. So I won't go into that in detail here. We might do so in the Q&A, but that's something to keep an eye on. All right. So I've discussed the forces that led to the rule. I've discussed the rule itself. I've discussed potential changes that we might see to the final rule. In my final bit of this talk, I want to preemptively discuss some of the criticisms of this rule, of this policy. And so, for starters, to be worried about diminishing the ESA, you have to first believe that the statute is working, and it isn't. So here I'm leaning on an excellent study that was done by Jonathan's colleague at PERC, Catherine Wright. So according to her research, the agencies have listed under the Endangered Species Act, ESA, 1,732 species, so a little more than 1,700 species. So decades ago, the government estimated, it modeled, that it would by now have recovered, have fixed a delisted species due to an ESA success, 300 of these species, okay? The actual number is 57, all right? That's out of 1,732. And that's after 50 years of work, 50 years, billions of dollars, scores of billions of dollars worth of regulatory headaches, 57 out of 1,732. All right, this data allows us to grade the government's performance under the ESA. So I'm using a 100-point scale here. If we talk in absolute numbers, the government scores a 3 out of 100, so 57 out of 1,732. And if you use the government's own yardstick for success, its projected numbers for successfully recovered species, then the government scores a 16 out of 100. These are failing grades, no matter how lenient the curve. So it's perhaps worth dwelling why this would be so. Why is the statute a demonstrable failure? And I think we can point to two things. The first would be its incentive structure. It's all about negative incentives. It's all about command, control, punishment. This is sort of dissonant with the way human beings work, and it leads to indeed perverse incentives for landowners, who often will destroy, make their property uninhabitable for potentially an endangered species rather than incur regulatory liability, or will even, this is the phrase for it, shoot, shovel, and shut up. That is to say, kill the species and their property, bury it, and tell no one about it so they don't incur any regulatory liability. That's part and parcel of the statute's negative incentives. And after 50 years, it might be time to try something new, perhaps. And the second reason why this statute has not been a success, in my opinion, and I think the numbers bear this out, is because it's not a bunch of white-coated bureaucrats who are wholly disinterested, and they're the ones calling the shots, just trying to preserve, you know, important species. If so, the regime wouldn't be so objectionable. It's like everything else in D.C. It's like every other agency. Politics call the shots. Special interests call the shots. It's no coincidence that so many threatened and endangered species occur next to oil and gas developments, because these are prioritized by the special interests that, environmental special interest. So it's not some sterile, sanitized scientific playground. It's far from it. It's politics as usual. And that's inimical to the bill's success. It gets caught in this flip-flopping cycle of policy that we've, alas, been in D.C. for about 20 years now. So that's my two cents. It's sort of the past, present, and future of what's going on and why I welcome it and why I think it's a big deal. Thank you.
Thanks, Will. Kerrigan?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Will, for that really helpful introduction. I think it frames things up really nicely. And I think your Chevron deference point you started with was so key to this. There's a nice study from like 2017 by a couple of professors looking at Chevron deference in the courts. And they said on step one, it's only about 40% of the time that agencies won. But when you get to Chevron step two, agencies won almost 94% of the time. And because most of the analyses went to Chevron step two, agencies won 70% of won about 80% of the time. And this is at circuit court levels, right? So we tended to know what the law was. It tended to be whatever the agencies said the law was. And that gave you some regulatory certainty. And of course, Loper Bright says that we aren't going to do that anymore, right? We're not going to defer to these agencies. And instead, we're going to find what the single best meaning of the law is, as written by Congress. And I think one of the reasons we saw so much deference in the ESA setting is that this is like a very technical, very science heavy area. Ecosystems are complex. Definitions of like, what is a species? I thought that would be super easy. And it turns out it's really not. You know, I do a lot of fishing and trying to figure out, is this trout a species or is it a subspecies that's also protected, or even a distinct population segment, which the Act protects, is really tricky and really hard. And I have no idea on the side of the stream, you know, so it's very hard to figure these things out. And I think that's why Chevron has historically played such a kind of critical role here. Okay, but zooming out for a second, for the people who aren't like really environmental nerds on this issue, I thought maybe I'd frame up kind of what exactly this rule is trying to do. So Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act is where the take prohibition, the kind of central protection for species, comes from in the Act. And it says, with respect to any endangered species of fish or wildlife listed pursuant to Section 4, it is unlawful for any person subject to the jurisdiction of the United States to take any such species within the United States of the territorial sea of the U.S. Okay, so that's our take prohibition that we talk about in the ESA. And then the Act provides a definition for take, right? And that definition for take says, take is to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, collect, or to attempt to engage in any such conduct. Okay. All the way back in 1975, Secretary of Interior promulgated a regulation defining what harm meant within that take definition. And then that was amended a little bit in 1981 without really changing the meaning of that definition. And that, what that definition is, I'm reading this from the proposed regulatory change. The old definition was defined as an act which actually kills or injures wildlife. And then it went on to say in the definition, such an act may include significant habitat modification or degradation where it actually kills or injures wildlife by significantly impairing essential behavioral patterns, including breeding, feeding, or sheltering. Right. And as Will pointed out, this brings some actions by landowners that you might not think would be a take within the kind of broad take definition. Section 9 itself does very little work. We actually don't see a whole lot of take prosecutions under the act, but it sets up, as Will said, a lot of the rest of the act, right? It's what pushes private landowners into the Section 10 permits for incidental take, which results in the habitat conservation plans and kind of the long and involved sometimes permitting process. So this thing itself doesn't do a whole lot. The government isn't out there like prosecuting people for take directly very often, occasionally, but really not very often. But it sets up a whole lot of the rest of the act. So where this gets kind of tricky, right? The administration's proposed this definition. And my kind of short version of a take on this is that the administration almost certainly has the power to redefine what harm means. I don't think one can argue that they don't. This would have been true before Loper-Bright, definitely true under Chevron. The barrier was maybe a little bit higher under Chevron and the kind of associated stuff about changing a longstanding interpretation of the law or longstanding regulation. But the agency almost certainly has the power to do this. What's tricky, though, is that they're trying to rely on Loper-Bright to say that we have to do this and there's no discretion here. We don't need to do NEPA review, no National Environmental Policy Act, Environmental Impact Statement review, because there's no discretion. We're forced really to move on to this new definition where we get rid of the harm approach because of Loper-Bright. And I don't think that's true. Loper-Bright kind of went out of the way to talk about this issue. And it says, I'm quoting Loper-Bright here. We do not call into question prior cases that relied on the Chevron framework, the holding of those cases that specific agency actions are lawful, including the Clean Air Act holding of Chevron itself, are still subject to statutory stare decisis, despite our change in interpretive methodology. Mere reliance on Chevron cannot constitute a special justification for overruling a holding, because to say a precedent relied on Chevron is at best just an argument the precedent was wrongly decided. That's not enough to justify overruling the statutory precedent. Now, I want to be real clear, I'm not saying that means the administration can't do this, right? That seems to be aimed at litigants who would sue to try and have a old regulation overturned. And if somebody was suing to try and get rid of this harm regulation, that language would be directly on point. But the administration's trying to rely on that language as a way to kind of fast track this through and avoid doing that NEPA analysis. I think that that's where the rule is really weak. So I think that we'll see legal challenges focused on that aspect of this rulemaking. And I think that those have a fair chance at success. I think it's hard to say that this is actually compelled by Loper-Bright or by the Endangered Species Act itself. We'll see what happens, right? But I think the administration could do this if it went through a kind of longer and more involved rulemaking to justify it. Okay. So moving beyond the question of power to do it and the way that it's being done, I think the change is going to dramatically decrease protection for species, which I think is partially the point, or maybe the point's more to enable property owners to do what they want with their property without the limitations of the Endangered Species Act. And we can definitely, we'll spend some time talking about success of the act. 99% of species that have been listed by the act have had their slide arrested and have not gone extinct. So from my view, maybe you're talking about 99% success rate, which is a pretty high A. I'm not going to say it's great. Like, there's a lot of things we should be doing differently in terms of which species we decide to protect and how we protect those species and really looking for recovery. But we can talk about that later on if we get to it in the questions. I don't think, though, that this is going to really cut through the red tape, because there's still a fair amount of habitat protection in the act, especially under Section 7. So any action, including private actions that need a government permit, still have to go through Section 7 of the act. Section 7 says that each federal agency shall ensure that any action authorized, funded, or carried out by the agency is not likely to jeopardize the continued existence of any endangered species or threatened species, or result in the destruction or adverse modification of the habitat of such species, where habitat is defined there as critical habitat. So there's still really strong habitat protection for any action that needs that federal federal approval, federal funding, federal authorization. Right, which means that an awful lot of actions are still going to be covered. There's also, as Will pointed out, that harass definition. Harass was also defined by the agencies, and it means an intentional or negligent act or omission which creates the likelihood of injury to wildlife by annoying it to such an extent as to significantly disrupt normal behavioral patterns, which include but are not limited to breeding, feeding, or sheltering. So maybe you can't say that cutting down the trees that a woodpecker uses for habitat is harm after this change in a rule. That's probably harassing the woodpecker still, right? It certainly would annoy me if someone came in and cut my house down, and that would probably prevent me from sheltering in my house anymore, which means that harass definition is kind of a big meaty hook that's hanging out there. Maybe it will get adjusted in the final rule, although you'd probably want to get comment on that if it's a whole new section of the act. If I were advising the government, I'd tell them they'd want to get comment on that piece. And maybe I'll kind of close with, two things. One, habitat's really important for species. If we look at how many species are in trouble in the United States, 81% of the species are listed because of habitat loss or habitat degradation, and only 17% are threatened by direct killing, people going out and shooting or harvesting these things. And that was a 2017 study that found that. A 1998 study put it at 85% habitat, 17% due to direct killing. Other big one that shows up a lot is pollution, and that pollution piece is going to be hard to get at, kind of depending on what definition we end up with. So the last piece I want to flag, I think I have time, Jonathan, for one more. Okay, cool. It's a question of like, what are we supposed to be thinking is actually a take then after this rule goes through? If we get rid of the harm definition, okay, and so all we have is take, and then take as defined by the act to include the harm, the harass, the all those other things, I don't really know what is and isn't take. The circuit court way back in Sweet Home said it was a direct application of force, but that didn't really work because we have this permits for kind of all of these unintentional and indirect harms that can happen. And so Justice Scalia in his dissent argues for a definition that says only actions directing at limited living animals. He says those actions are conduct directly and intentionally against a particular animal. And the majority there says, and I think this is right, like, okay, so if you had someone who drained a pond that had a population of endangered turtles living in it, and they were doing that because they needed to get, some carp out of the pond they didn't want anymore, they were going to make it nice bass habitat instead, that wouldn't be a take because that wasn't aimed at the turtles. And I don't think that's right. Like, the act prescribes any like knowing killing of a listed species. And that's the standard we get in the act itself, is knowing. And if that's the case, then like, it can't just be things that are intentionally directed against a particular animal or group of animals. And so it's maybe a little bit broader than that. So like, what about draining a river that salmon require when the salmon aren't in it? You're not directly killing them, you're getting rid of habitat, but when they come back, they aren't gonna have a place to breed. Is that take at that point? Or even the emissions piece, like the Fifth Circuit has said that not putting a roof on oil stabilization tanks was a take because listed species came and landed in those tanks and they died. And if you know that's gonna happen and you let it keep happening, like, that's not even a harm question, that's a broader take question, but we still don't exactly know what that take definition is if we're embracing the Sweet Home definition. So I'll stop there, but I think that's one of the big questions, is the uncertainty this introduces.
Thanks, Garendon. Will, do you want to take a minute or two for any response?
Sure. I agree with 90% of what the professor said, and I thought it was good stuff. I will a couple clarifications or slight disagreements I'll note. One, the agency, it was unclear whether or not it said it was in the proposal, whether or not it was compelled by Loper Bright. And I expect to the extent it could be interpreted to say so, that would be cleaned up in the final. I can't imagine that they've got smart enough legal counsel where I don't think they'd do that. The other one was with agreeing that it dramatically diminishes the act. This is something I wanted to mention in the primary talk. But 47 states have state-specific species protections, and that perhaps makes sense given that 60%, I think it is, of species listed under the ESA, the federal ESA, are intrastate non-commercial species, which sort of makes you wonder how Congress has regulatory authority over them to begin with. The final thing I wanted to note was with respect to the future, what is take? 100% agree. I mean, we've got ourselves quite a fluid situation here for the first time in 50 years. I see a spectrum. I see at one end of the spectrum, a spectrum of possibilities. One end of the spectrum, the Sweet Home test, basically what it is, the existing one, capacious. At the other end of the spectrum, the one advanced by my organization, which echoes Scalia's dissent, intentional, deliberate, direct action that injures, kills, harms a species that's listed. There is this in-between level, which I think was what the on-bank court of the D.C. Circuit was getting at in the precursor case to Sweet Home, the one that led to that was reviewed in Sweet Home. And that is taking out the intentional aspect to just any direct application of force that results in a death. So, you know, you build a wind turbine in the path of where you know birds are going to migrate, and you know it's absolutely foreseeable that it's going to chop up a million birds, you know, that would be that would comport with that definition of harm, you know, which would also make sense out of the incidental take provision. So those were the sort of the three points I had in response.
Thanks, Will. And I'll make a call for the audience. Please start loading your questions into the Q&A, and we'll get to those as they pop in. But maybe, Kerrigan, I'll ask you a question that you kind of touched on, but might merit some more discussion from both of you about Sweet Home as the elephant in the room. Should we think about Sweet Home as it's just a Chevron decision, which is what the agency kind of does? It just acts as if it's two paragraphs, says Chevron, and moves on, as opposed to discussing the statute and having strong arguments either way on what the proper meaning is. And then, like, the corollary to that is, how should a court confront that question? That here, post Loper Bright, an agency says the Supreme Court is wrong. What's a court supposed to do with that sort of question?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that Sweet Home does not say that this is the compelled reading of the act, that harm has to be defined in this way, right? And that question wasn't presented. I think that the majority there, and they had a majority for this, pushes back very hard on Scalia's dissent there, which is saying that harm has to be defined as this directed, intentional thing aimed at a particular individual of a protected species. So I do think that there was a majority there, I don't know that it's still. I don't think you're probably still going to get a majority for that. I have a hard time predicting what the Supreme Court is going to do generally with anything. I think it's worth thinking about, like, the way the rule was set up, which it really does seem to be designed to get this into court as quickly as possible. Right? You've essentially got one administration to do this, depending on what happens after, but you're only guaranteed one like 4-year period to get it in. And I think the administration probably wants to get it up to the Supreme Court if they possibly can, and get a definitive holding on what harm is. And I assume they're hoping for that holding that follows what Scalia's view was in Sweet Home, which is, I think, why they're not proposing an alternate definition, kind of why we have this fast rulemaking, why it happened so early in the administration. So, you know, to me, that kind of it's smart smart lawyering for sure to try and get this clean, straightforward, get an announcement from the courts as to what the rule is without an agency definition to muck it up at all. And that might really constrain how the Endangered Species Act is enforced in the future, and definitely would tie the hands of future administrations.
Will, any thoughts about that? Like maybe to put a finer point on it, because I think Kerrigan's right, this is basically a gamble that the Supreme Court will take it and will overturn Sweet Home. But until that happens, what's a district court and a circuit court supposed to do in this kind of situation?
Well, it's going to depend on the context. So judicial review of the repeal, I don't think is going to raise any substantive statutory issues. I think it's going to be an Administrative Procedure Act 702-706-2A challenge, arbitrary and capricious. Now, as I think has already been discussed, ESA is a citizen suit provision. So this is going to be litigated in the district courts via that mechanism. And what does a court say? Oh, geez, this is one of those real tough legal questions, because as your question suggests, you can read Sweet Home both ways. I mean, there is more meat in the bone of their statutory analysis than perhaps the administration lets on in their very brief proposal. But the court does say, we're not going to decide because we're deferring on Chevron step two. We find the statute to be ambiguous, so we're not ultimately deciding a statutory question. So it certainly will be argued both ways. A further complicating factor that makes this just a delicious legal question is that no one has any idea what the heck statutory stare decisis means in the wake of Loper Bright. This is what Professor Kerrigan just pointed out. So we've got multiple layers of uncertainty. In addition to this being a terra incognita, as I suggested before, because this is the first time an administration has ever gone this way. So look, a lot of uncertainties, and it's a fool's errand to prognosticate how it'll turn out. I'd imagine like a lot of things seem to turn out these days that we'll get one sort of opinion out of the Northern District of California and another sort of opinion out of the Eastern District of Texas. But that's, I'm just guesstimating. But you know, it's fluid, to be determined.
Hey, Jonathan, if I can just follow up on that for a second. So Scalia in his dissent has this great example. He says that he's talking about the definition of harm, rather, and talks about defining this way requires us to accept, this is quoting the language, that a farmer who tills his field and causes erosion that makes silt, a real fine dust running into a nearby river, which depletes oxygen and thereby impairs the breeding of a protected fish, has taken or attempted to take the fish, to take the strongest evidence to make us believe Congress has defined a term in a manner that would do this, right? That's, in his view, repugnant to the ordinary meaning. And so like, what's a court supposed to do if it gets that case? And I look at that and I'm like, yeah, if you do this every year and you're killing the fish in the river every year, like, that's take. You're killing fish is foreseeable. You're not doing it on purpose, so it doesn't meet Scalia's definition. But I think to me, it meets the definition. But if we're taking Scalia's definition as the definition, then maybe it doesn't anymore. And I think that's like he pulls it out as like, look at this crazy case. And I'm like, maybe I'm crazy then, because that looks like harm or take to me. But I don't know what a court's going to do with that.
Well, I would say there's lots of cases like that out there, certainly in the citizen suit world. A related question on Loper Bright that I've been puzzling over is, Kerrigan, you mentioned there's not a lot of time for an administration to do something this dramatic and get the Supreme Court to overturn its prior precedent. So assuming that doesn't happen, could this be undone by a future administration? Like, how would you think about a future administration adopting what might not be the best reading of the statute, but is consistent with a past Chevron precedent?
Yeah, Will, do you want to try taking that one first?
Yeah, indeed. Of course, anything one administration can do, another administration can undo or do, you know, vice versa. That's the way these things normally ping pong in a lot of issue areas, especially in the environment and labor policy, but not the ESA until now. It will be hard. Look, again, the difference would be how the judicial review proceeds. So what the Trump administration is trying to do is to take any question of statutory interpretation off the table for judicial review of what it's doing. They only want review under EPA's very deferential arbitrary and capricious standard. any administration that subsequently reimposed the harm rule as it exists now would then have to defend that interpretation of the ESA during judicial review. Start in the D court, the district court, and go to the circuit court, and perhaps ultimately the Supreme Court. So that is, look, by then, we might have more certainty in the district or, you know, in the federal courts. I mean, that is, you know, we may have even had the Supreme Court weigh in by then due to one of these citizen suits. So, you know, it's dynamic. It is my long-winded answer to cut to the point is certainly yes. A subsequent administration can try to reimpose the harm rule. However, it's going to have to defend that harm rule on judicial review in a world without Chevron deference.
Yeah, I'd echo the same. Like, I think that the loss of Chevron doesn't change the way that we the government's allowed to change regulations over time. So I don't see a difference there. I think one of the things that we haven't talked about so much that's going to be a core piece of this is, I think the next administration, even without redoing the rule, can try and make a lot of determinations that kind of cloak these decisions about habitat and what harm is within the kind of arbitrary and capricious standard, right? So this is a factual determination. In this case, this is harm caused by this thing. We're relying on the science here, and that means that this is take. And if you can, like, the more you can kind of shove, and I think every administration is going to do this, right? With Chevron gone, then you want to shove stuff into a factual determination or a policy determination where you are still going to get deference. And those lines are not easy to draw. Like, we pretend like they're easy to figure out, but it gets real complicated real quickly on those.
John, I think another point, super quick. In the midst of an empirical examination of how the Department of Justice is arguing administrative law cases in the wake of Loper's demise, I mean, the DOJ, they're strategic just like any other lawyer. So what sort of ersatz deference mechanisms are they employing? And man, seeing it time and time again, just what you say, we'll see this dueling brief narrative where the petitioner is portraying the issue as statutory construction, clear, and the agency has contravened, exceeded their authority under the statute, and the government always framing it as arbitrary and capricious. This is policymaking discretion. Get out of our hair, courts. So that's definitely, I mean, I've witnessed, or not witnessed, but I've been reading about that battle taking place in real time.
Thanks. A couple of policy questions I think underlie the two statutory interpretation perspectives here. One is probably the most memorable line from Justice Scalia's dissent in Sweet Home was the idea that the interpretation, quote, imposes unfairness to the point of financial ruin upon the simplest farmer who finds his land conscripted to national zoological use. That was 30 years ago. Has that fear been borne out? Like, I wonder what we think about that today and how that kind of thinking might influence the court. That's for either of you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really marks the ESA, Dave Owen, who's a scholar out here, has written about this a little bit. He calls it the negotiable implementation of environmental law, where almost all of the environmental law implementation is done via negotiation. And so there's a lot of ways that the both administration or both kind of sides, different administrations have softened the ESA to try and avoid that financial ruin piece, right? You see things like safe harbor agreements, you see the HCPs. So there's few cases where you're told you just can't do this. And the real famous, I guess we can call them the financial ruin cases, right? The big conflict ESA fights over things like the spotted owl, those tend to be on federal land and not so much on private land. And I'm not saying that there aren't horror stories about this, right? But like, we live in a society where we have restrictions on what we can do with land. And we see it in zoning, we see it in local land use decisions, and we see it under the Clean Water Act, and we see protected under the Endangered Species Act. So yeah, some people it does hit a little bit harder, but I think most of the time administrations have found a way to soften that blow. And we've seen it from both sides. The Clinton administration during the kind of Newt Gingrich's efforts to reform the ESA really pushed through a lot of those changes. And others have become core to how the Endangered Species Act happens. Agencies like to say yes in the end.
Thanks, Gary. Will, I want you to touch on that, but I want to add a policy consideration for you to talk about, which Kerrigan raised earlier, which is that loss of habitat is the primary threat to most endangered and threatened species. Does the ESA even make sense if there's not a general prohibition on habitat destruction?
What do you mean as like a purposive conceptual matter or as a matter of statutory interpretation, or are you saying?
Yeah, I mean, purpose or policy, that like if Congress was trying to prevent species extinction, how should we think about the fact that this takes the biggest threat for most species off the table for direct regulation?
Well, I mean, shoot, I guess I'd revert listeners or direct listeners to or viewers to that spiel I had about how unsuccessful the ESA has been, you know, to worry about diminishing a law. The law has to be effective as an initial matter. But regarding such concerns, the law is written the way the law is written and should be interpreted the way it's written without deference. And if it isn't stringent enough, and I frankly, I don't know if I'm buying the notion that if it doesn't cover speculative harms to species due to habitat modification, then all of a sudden we've utterly neutered the act. I don't buy into that. But if that were the case, then lawmakers should act. They should amend the act. They should amend the act as it was originally. That is to say, you know, with the language that actually specifies that habitat modification is included in take, but they took that language out. Now, of course, I'm a good originalist. I give no credence to legislative history, but the nonetheless, you know, it is there. I did want to touch upon one thing. Oh, golly, it was the other question regarding a little guy. And so that quote you had, that was the Rube Goldberg type litigation I was talking about. It still happens as recently as 2024. The Ninth Circuit in Cascadia or affirmed in Cascadia Wildlands v. Scott Timber. The court reasoned the plaintiffs were not required to show, or the government wasn't required to show, an actual injury beyond significant impairment. So, you know, that's sort of dubious, or that's what one of these terrible examples. And then my real point here is, in preparation for this call, I reviewed the comments, the docket, the regulatory docket for the proposal, and farmer group after farmer group. I mean, here's the Georgia Farm Bureau. For decades, the current definition of harm has imposed significant burdens on Georgia's farmers, ranchers, and foresters. Idaho, they basically say the same thing about ranchers. And the upshot is, I don't think they're lying. And there's a pretty darn extensive record with a bunch of examples on the comment docket from all these groups and organizations that indicate how, yes, 30 years later, that's how it did play out. And not just through the direct Rube Goldberg type litigation that, as the professor said, was largely citizen suits, not brought by the government, but in the way that this definition reverberates throughout the act, makes its other components so much more onerous, so much more stringent, so much more full of red tape.
I do think, well, just on that, the like habitat as proxy for take piece, it's an interesting question, right? Where like in Section 7 consultations, it's often the case that it's hard to get good data on how many individuals of a species are getting killed. And so the agency sometimes will use habitat destruction as a proxy to evaluate how many individuals of a species are getting killed. And I don't think that's going to go away. Like, I think that's still a legit method to say, well, we don't know exactly how many are killing, but we know that for every acre you remove, there tends to be two of these critters in there. So if you remove more than 100 acres, we think you're probably killing more than 200 individuals of the species. And that's not a question of like how we're defining the harm at habitat, right? I think that's a question of like how we're figuring out if a take has happened or not. And you're like squarely into arbitrary and capricious review. But that gets super nerdy and like really, really deep diving ESA. I do want to talk, John, if I can just respond to the questions about how the act's working. And I think this is the Endangered Species Act, as we have chosen to implement it, is aimed at preventing extinction, right? Section 7 says we can't make it worse for species. Section 9 says we can't take species. The mechanisms to actually go out and recover species, like there's language in there that says agencies are supposed to be doing that, but that language has generally not been seen as enforceable by the courts, right? The purpose, if you zoom out and look at the purpose of the act as set out by Congress, is to recover endangered species and the ecosystems they depend on. They put habitat in there, but the mechanisms that we've used and the way the funding's been, we haven't looked at recovering. We've just kind of arrested the slide. I would argue that part of why we haven't been able to do that, and part of why we as Will pointed out at the very beginning, why so many of these listed species are around oil and gas things, for example, is that there's never been enough money to kind of do endangered species the way that the law originally set out to do the endangered species thing. And I think that's in part because the government maybe bit off more than it realized it was biting off when we passed the act in the first place. But the fact that there isn't enough money to evaluate all the species, that it's almost entirely driven by litigation at this point, means that you're going to be saving the species that are most in trouble. You're going to be trying to arrest slides and keep those species from going extinct. You're going to be less focused on recovery for those species. And because the agencies are really like listing these species for protection when they're getting sued, you're going to be only listing the species that are the ones that are really threatened by habitat destruction or by other kind of elements that are pushing them towards extinction. So it's not a surprise, I think, that we haven't seen species recovered given how we implement the act. And it's probably also not a surprise that the species that are most likely to be listed are those that people are suing to get listed, because the agencies aren't doing it on their own based on science.
Thanks, Gary. Turn to one of the audience questions, which picks up on this speculative harm. I think, Will, you've been calling it a Rube Goldberg sort of situation, where the question is essentially, is there a seven counties like solution here where you tighten the level of causation, so you require foreseeability or proximate causation to narrow take. I don't know, but the question's not clear whether it's as an alternative to this or in addition to this, but I wonder if you guys have any thoughts about that question in the wake of Seven County.
Shoot, I'm all for a belt and suspenders approach when it comes to lessening this particular regulatory burden. I don't know if I know. Well, yes. I'll say this. Some circuit courts have adopted a tighter requirement for proximate causation, but other courts, and in particular the Ninth, has not. So it is, that is the solution proffered by the questioner is an excellent one. It doesn't go as far as I would like. You know, nixing the existing expansive definition is, I think, the preferred policy. However, what the questioner suggests is indeed the solution that a number of circuit courts have adopted. And it does keep at bay the worst of the Rube Goldberg type litigation that I've been talking of. But again, other circuits don't. And in the Ninth, you know, they've also got the Northern District of California, which is perhaps conducive to the more fanciful of these sorts of suits.
Yeah, I mean, I think foreseeable seems to me to be what the majority in Sweet Home was looking for, and I don't have big issues with foreseeable as a limitation. And Connor pushed back on that in the concurrence in Sweet Home, where the focus really was on like there are some of these causation links that get real long, right? Like the goats in Hawaii that are eating the seedlings of the trees that this palila, the bird, needs to survive. And Connor pretty clearly thought that was wrong. Thought that was not close enough to be a real harm under the act. And like, I don't know, maybe it's because I did a PhD in ecology and like study these long causation things. And I'm like, that's pretty short. Like long is like otters not eating enough of the little critters that eat the seaweed. And so the seaweed dying back, which is why I can't catch any bass off the coast in California anymore. Like then you're getting pretty long, but generally we have not seen success on those like super long causation chain pieces, right? One step, maybe two steps, but like the you know, there's a case about water right permitting by a state and how much water then was flowing down into a wetland that supported crabs that whooping cranes would eat, right? And it was a question of whether allowing people to take water, like the state allowing people to take water, was a take under the act. And the court said no, like that's just too far removed, right? So there's definitely cases where the courts have reined these things in, and I don't think we see a ton of these really long causal chains. It would be neat to have a study. Maybe Will, you and I can write this together, like how long are our causal chains in these in these things? But my sense is that they don't tend to be quite as long.
Thanks. So final audience question. It goes to the point that both of you raised about how take and harm to play out throughout the rest of the statute. And so the question is, how will this rescission affect implementation of critical habitat, especially in areas that are not currently occupied?
Yeah, maybe, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it affects the designation of critical habitat at all. Right? This is just focused on the take piece. We can talk about the broader kind of reading of the act and what it means for this, but I don't think that the critical habitat designation piece is going to change, and that part of Section 7 consultations I don't think will change.
Seconded.
All right. We've gone through the audience questions. We have only about 8 minutes left, so maybe I'll give each of you a chance for any final comments or to bring any topics that we missed and that are, you know, you burn in to get out there, and then we'll wrap at the half hour.
I do think one of the pieces kind of going to the broader point of the act is that when we have this, you know, we have this list of reasons for which a species can be listed. And one of the reasons that the species can be listed is like the very first one, right, is the present or threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of its habitat or range. And that's one of the comments I think that I've heard a bunch from folks is it would be strange to have an act where that's recognized as the primary threat to listed species, or the very first of the reasons that species can be listed, and not have a mechanism that addresses that at all within the take definition. There's other parts of the act, and maybe you think that that's the way it's supposed to be addressed, but to say that we can't protect habitat at all through the take definition seems like a kind of strained reading of the act.
Will?
Let's see, there's nothing I haven't said. I definitely support this measure. I support reforming the ESA in general. All these negative incentives, I don't think that's the way to go. I will note this is sort of an aside. I hope not too fanciful, but this is another instance, this whole, much at the heart of this discussion, of the power, the talismanic power of a good Scalia dissent. We've seen this in issue area after issue area, but me as a proponent of ESA reform, reining it in, I'm very lucky to have, you know, a Scalia dissent, the tremendous wind at one's back, wind at one's back in this current jurisprudential environment. I don't want to overstate it, but that's a really important, perhaps unstated, driving factor here. I mean, there's nothing better for a policy in, again, today's jurisprudential, legal, and political environment than if it's bolstered and indeed founded on a really good Scalia dissent. So sort of a testament to his lasting effect, that of his dissent in Sweet Home, or Babbitt v. Sweet Home, and the effect it's still having.
I got a sure good right, huh? it reads real nicely. Yeah. Hey, Jonathan, maybe one final point, if you don't mind. So I don't know, at the risk of like papering things over, I do want to think kind of broadly about this question of like, is this marking a dive by the GOP away from the center on environmental issues? Like, what's the future look like here? And one of the things that's constantly surprised me about the Endangered Species Act is the support for the act, the support for protecting species and preventing extinction is consistently strong, like on polling. And even when you're comparing it to development, like it does better than I would, you know. I grew up in Kansas and in a kind of little blue bubble city, Lawrence, Kansas, in a pretty big red state. And my sense was always like, nobody cares about this, but it's not true. Lots of people care about species protection. Lots of people care about taking care of their land. You talk to the farmers, and the farmers are the stewards of the land, right? This is so key to the way that they see themselves, the way they see their relation to the environment. And if you go back a ways, right, you go back to like the first effective protection for species in the United States, we brought it in from hunting groups. It was hunters who decided to tax ourselves, right? Like, we tax ourselves on our guns and our ammo in order to fund endangered species protection. Fishermen did the same thing. And this is really effective protection for species and conservation so that we can keep using these species. I tell my students, and like, you know, I'm trying to convince them, but nobody loves a duck as much as somebody who wants to go shoot a duck. Like, if you hunt ducks, you cannot do that if there aren't ducks to shoot. And so I think as the dust kind of settles on this over maybe the next 20 years, figuring out like what environmental protection looks like and how this reemerges on the things that we do agree on, like how we accomplish the goals that people want, right? I think people want clean water. I think people want abundant game species. And I think we want to protect these really cool, really rare species too. And so I think the question becomes like, how do we do that in a way that more people can get behind? Because I think it is possible to build a really broad coalition around this.
That is a great point to end on. It's probably a broader point well beyond the ESA. Like, so many environmental issues are conflicts over how, not whether or why. But with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Matthew.
Thank you. Yeah, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. I enjoyed listening to the conversation as well. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.